This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is exiled black South African poet Dennis Brutus, who barely survived his imprisonment for anti-apartheid activities. Brutus helped lead the movement to expel South Africa from the Olympics. The South African government retaliated against Brutus's efforts to integrate sports by firing him from his job teaching high school English. He had taught for 14 years. At the same time, the government banned him from participating in any political or social activities. In 1963, Brutus was arrested for breaking the ban. He was shot and nearly killed when he tried to escape. Brutus was patched up to face 18 months of hard labor in South Africa's most brutal prison, Robben Island. That was followed by a sentence of 5 years under house arrest, in which he was banned from writing anything that could be published. After 1 year of this house arrest, he signed an exit permit which allowed him to leave the country, but promised his immediate imprisonment if he ever returns. After living in exile in England for several years, he moved to the United States in 1970, where he was given permanent residence in 1983 as a resident alien. This followed efforts by the Immigration and Naturalization Service to deport him. In America, Brutus has served on the faculties of several universities, including Northwestern University and Swarthmore College. Dennis Brutus has written poems about his imprisonment, his life in exile, and the cruelties of the apartheid system. This is his poem, Sirens, Knuckles, Boots.
The sounds begin again. The siren in the night, the thunder at the door, the shriek of nerves in pain. Then the keening crescendo of faces split by pain. The wordless, endless wail. Only the unfree know. Importunate as rain, the wraiths exhale their woe. Over the sirens, knuckles, boots, my sounds begin again.
When I spoke with Dennis Brutus, I asked him if it was a difficult decision to become an anti-apartheid activist, knowing the risks involved for him and his family.
I think it was less difficult because it was a graduated decision. First, of course, because of the sports thing, I was being raided my home periodically by the secret police, and they would carry off my papers. Then I was given a warning as a teacher to stay out of politics, and finally I was dismissed from teaching and forbidden to teach. Now, at each stage, I had to consider whether to continue, and I could always see the next stage because there was a familiar pattern. And I would discuss it with my wife, and indeed we talked it through all the way to the point where I said to her that sooner or later I will go to prison, that you can continue opposing for so long, and they will apply various pressures. The ultimate pressure would be imprisonment, and we agreed that I would take that risk as well. The curious thing was that I assured her that if I was in prison, one other possibility still existed, that I might be found dead, and there would be a report that I had been killed trying to escape, and if she ever heard that, she should refuse to believe it. And she should insist on an investigation, because I would not do this if I was in prison. The irony here is that eventually I did precisely what I said I would not do when I was shot in the back by the secret police attempting to escape, and I had, in fact, been attempting to escape. So when she saw me in hospital, she reproached me and said, you had told me you would never do this, you know, what happened? But I think the circumstances justified it. I had escaped from South Africa. I was then on bail, facing a charge for attending a meeting of the South African Olympic Committee. And I got to Mozambique, which was then a Portuguese colony, and the Portuguese returned me to South Africa. But no one knew that I had been returned, and everybody assumed that I had succeeded in escaping. And the only way to make them aware that I had failed was to attempt another escape in a public place and risk being shot, since they were both armed. They had armpit holsters with guns. But I decided the only way to make people aware that I was in fact back in Johannesburg while they were under the impression that I was outside the country was to attempt another escape.
And you were shot in the back at very close range.
Well, close enough for the bullet to go clear through me. It entered my back and came out of my chest and had penetrated the intestines and just missed the heart. It was pretty serious. I wasn't sure I was going to survive. I remember the man who shot me, Sergeant Hellberg, saying to me as I lay on the sidewalk on the main street in Johannesburg, just outside the Anglo-American Corporation, which is the great mining conglomerate. And I lay on the sidewalk, and Sergeant Hellberg said to me, "Anyway, Brutus, I hope you survive." And I said, "Well, I hope so, too." And in fact, I was taken to hospital and then operated on after that.
It's almost surprising that you were given good enough medical treatment to survive after that.
Yes. In fact, it's just possible that they lost control of the situation at that time and so settled into the normal routine. Here is a man who was shot. You take him to hospital. You operate on him. And that's it. You know, you try and save his life. There were some complications. The ambulance that came for me, for instance, this was so macabre. The men got out in uniform and they took out a stretcher and they looked at me and they put their stretcher back and they got back in the ambulance and they drove off. And I said to Hellberg, who was beside me, "Why are they leaving?" I was very alarmed. And he said, "Well, Brutus, you wouldn't want them to lose their job, would you? This is an ambulance for whites, and so you'll have to wait for the black ambulance to come along." And then when it did come, six members of the police got into the ambulance with me and sat there with notebooks poised and started questioning me about people that they should contact on my behalf. But clearly this was in an effort to get leads. And then perhaps the most Kafkaesque part of it was when the doctors started operating, the police insisted on being in the operating theater. And the doctors protested and said, "Well, look, you're covered with germs. You've got to be sterile. We can't have you here." So they said, "Well, hold it." And they went off and came back, all masked and in gloves and covered boots and whatnot, and they stood there at the table. And the doctors then said, "Well, we can't work with you standing around us. It's impossible." And they refused to leave. And so I sat up and said that I think these men are hoping to get a statement out of me, perhaps under anesthetic. So perhaps I should make a statement now, and then they would leave you to get on with the work. So they agreed, and they took out their notebooks. And I said, "Well, I regret nothing. I would do this again if necessary, because I think this is an unjust system, and that's all I intend to say." And then they withdrew to the doorway of the theater and stood there, but I think they gave up at that point.
You were later taken to Robben Island, which is considered the most hellish of all the prisons in South Africa, and it's supposedly unescapable. It's supposed to be escape-proof.
Yes, well, no one has ever escaped. That's true. Those who managed to get off the island were usually found dead. Their corpses would be washed up on the beach of Cape Town subsequently. No one, as far as I know, has succeeded in escaping and living. And, of course, I spent time there with people like Nelson Mandela and Walter Sisulu, Govan and Becky and Ahmed Kathrada. We broke stones together. We were given rocks every day and a hammer, and we broke rocks.
Could you describe the prison a little bit and why it is so unescapable?
Well, it's heavily guarded, heavily fortified. The wardens were all white. The prisoners are all black. Automatic rifles. There's barbed wire. There's sentry posts. There are helicopters which circle the island. And in fact, when I got there, I was part of a span, as it's called, or a team, that had to carry rocks out of the sea and up the beach to build a wall around the island. And in fact, one of my poems deals with that, because I was so covered with bruises, and I was beaten while I was working, that I became a kind of a spectacle. And every evening when we stripped, we were required to stand naked outside the cells and be searched. The wardens would come along and inspect my bruises. And I felt a little like a freak in the circus, a two-headed calf, or a bearded lady, or a tattooed lady, as I call it. So perhaps I should just read it at this point. For a while, I was the tattooed lady of the prison, and wardens would come to our section and get me to strip and stare and whistle in mingled pleasure and horror at the great purple bruise that ran from my neck down my back, from my neck to my thighs in a purple mass. What was I then? Mute, enduring reproach, heroic endurer, Christianly hero, or submissive fool? What was I then that I cannot now imagine, cannot now judge?
Did you consider the beatings that you were subjected to and the hard labor as well a form of torture of political prisoners?
I think so. Although it was so random and unsystematic, they just decided to teach us that Robben Island was really Hell Island, and so they beat us at the slightest provocation, and very often without provocation. It was really an attempt to demoralize us, and they saw political prisoners as far more dangerous than murderers or rapists or anybody else. And so it was important for them to humiliate us because they saw us as a threat to the system.
Robben Island had a mix of political prisoners like yourself and people who were there on criminal offenses. Did you mix it all, and was there any attempt to politicize the criminals?
There were. When I arrived there, I became one of 1,100 political prisoners. And in addition, we had 200 who were there for multiple murders, multiple rapes. The government described them as the scum of the prison system, or the dregs of the prison system. They were the worst in the country. And these 200 were then put in charge of the political prisoners. They took us to work, they gave us our food, they beat us up. So mix is probably not the right word. Certainly we were together, but they were dominant over us on behalf of the guards. So the guards, in fact, simply gave the orders, but these orders were carried out, and the supervision was by what were called often blow bikies, and that's translated as blue jackets, and they were lifers, people who would never come out of prison and who therefore wore a different uniform. They wore little blue jackets, and they were rather proud of their status. And they also, of course, collaborated with the wardens in beating us up and would then be rewarded for having performed these duties. Often they ate our food as well. They were due to deliver it to us in our cells each evening. But if they chose to, of course, we went without it.
While you're in Robben Island, you are prohibited from writing anything that anyone would be interested in publishing.
Oh, yes, although, in fact, much of that took place after I was released in 1965. But in prison, I was allowed one letter every 6 months, one letter in, one letter out. And, of course, in between, I was not permitted any paper or pencils. So you simply didn't write. We would sometimes steal the lead or the graphite out of a pen or a pencil and break it off and conceal it in the mats that we slept on the concrete floor. So I did some writing on toilet paper, but this was discovered by the guards and destroyed.
What do you think kept you alive emotionally and spiritually during the period of your imprisonment?
Mm-hmm. Oh, again, I suppose there's several possible answers. The one I was going to mention earlier, talking about the tattooed lady poem, I think it helps enormously to have a sense of humor if you can see the absurdity of your position. And I think when I was being whistled at and gazed at by the wardens because my body was just a mass of bruises, the way I distanced myself from it was by saying, well, this is a little like being on show in a circus. So that helps, certainly. It also helps, of course, to have some religious base, some reservoir of religious strength. But, of course, not everybody can draw on that. And, in fact, it can be very dangerous. I had a spell in isolation of almost 5 months where I began to suffer from very serious hallucinations. And because there was no one that I could talk to, there was no way of testing your perceptions against reality. And so there's no way of realizing that you're slipping into this hallucinatory state. I ended up twice attempting suicide, and looking back, I know that had I not been in isolation and had I not had certain religious obsessions and guilts that come to the surface when you're in isolation, it would not have happened. So I can see some peril as well in religious beliefs. But I think what keeps people going, and if I can find it, I might read a poem about it, because I think it answers your question in another way. What gives people the strength to go on is the knowledge that there are people outside who support them in the struggle. That's primary source of strength, which keeps your morale going. The conviction that there are people outside who care and support you in your struggle and are working for change and are working for your freedom. And it comes to the surface particularly once a year in prison. The political prisoners sing. They're not allowed to sing normally, and they're punished if they sing. But there was a day when we would defy the prison regulations and sing in spite of the ban on singing. And the song we sang was the anthem of the liberation movement. It's called Nkosi Sikelela, or God Bless Africa, Nkosi Sikelela Africa. So this is a poem about South Africa Freedom Day, the day when we sing. Today in prison, by tacit agreement, they will sing just one song, Nkosi Sikelela. Slowly and solemnly, with suppressed passion and pent-up feeling. The voice is strong and steady, but with tears close and sharp behind the eyes, and the mind ranging wildly as a strayed bird, seeking some names to settle on, and deeds being done, and those who will do the much that still needs to be done.
After you got out of Robben Island, you were then sentenced to house arrest, which means basically you can't leave, no one can come see you, your communications are cut off. But nevertheless, did that feel liberating after getting out of hard labor and constant beatings?
I'm not sure. I can't recall my state of mind as specifically as that. What I knew was that I was extremely frustrated to be out, but not to be free. To be out, but inactive. And so I took enormous risks because I continued to write and publish under a pseudonym. I still met with people who were politically active in the underground. And I was always taking risks, but what complicated it was that the police would send people to visit me. And, of course, the idea was to trap me and find me engaged in conversation with someone and then send me back to prison for the crime of violating my house arrest order. And sadly, some of the people they sent were people who had been in prison with me and who had made a deal with the secret police that in exchange for their freedom, they would then entrap others and get them imprisoned. And so, had I stayed, I would certainly have gone back to prison. So, on the one hand, there was the sense of being useless, and the other hand, the sense of the possibility of going back to Robben Island to break stones, and that's an equally useless occupation. I mean, there's really no creative satisfaction in sitting over a pile of rocks. So I think it was the sensible thing for me to do, to leave the country. I signed what's called an exit permit, which meant agreeing that if I ever returned to South Africa, I would go to prison, and being allowed to leave under those circumstances.
There's a poem, there's many poems you wrote about being in exile, but there's one I'd like to ask you to read.
Uh-huh, I think it's the one about the predicament of exile.
Yeah.
It's part of a sequence for South Africa, and this is number two of the series. Each day, each hour is not painful. Exile is not amputation. There is no bleeding wound, no torn flesh and severed nerves. The secret is clamping down, holding the lid of awareness tight shut, sealing in the acrid, searing stench that scalds the eyes, swallows up the breath, and fixes the brain in a wail until some thoughtless questioner pries the sealed lid loose. I can exclude awareness of exile until someone calls me one.
What's your official status now in America, and do you feel secure that you will be allowed to stay indefinitely?
Well, that's open-ended, I think, but officially, it seems to me, I'm reasonably well situated. I now have a permanent residence. I'm a resident alien. I've chosen not to apply for American citizenship because I don't accept that I am not a South African citizen.
Would you want to go back to South Africa if apartheid fell?
Well, I'd like to be participating in the whole reconstruction process. And I think I'm currently making some contribution, and I expect to continue to make a contribution either inside or outside.
There's another poem I'd like to ask you to read about how certain positive emotions can persist and endure in spite of the oppression of apartheid.
This is an early one, written in a ghetto in South Africa, and in a sense talking about survival in the ghetto, and also at a time when my language was a lot more complex. I think in prison, when I was able to review my own work in solitary, because one needs to keep your mind busy there, I settled for a much simpler and more direct vocabulary and form of communication. But here I'm also dealing with a challenge of diction, because I'm trying to use highly political language in a poetic manner. I'm trying to turn slogans into lyrics, if you like. And so there's a kind of intriguing challenge to the craft of poetry, as well as a statement, a political statement. Somehow we survive, and tenderness, frustrated, does not wither. Investigating searchlights rake our naked, unprotected contours. Over our heads, the monolithic decalogue of fascist prohibition glowers and teeters for a catastrophic fall. Boots club the peeling door. But somehow we survive severance, deprivation, loss. Patrols uncoil along the asphalt dark, hissing their menace to our lives. Most cruel, all our land is scarred with terror, rendered unlovely and unlovable. Sundered are we, and all our passionate surrender. But somehow, tenderness survives.
That was exiled South African poet Dennis Brutus, who now lives in the United States, where he has resident alien status. Dennis Brutus's books of poems available in America include Stubborn Hope and A Simple Lust. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Ron Barron and Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.